Well, good evening, everyone. How are you doing? Pretty good? Oh, come on, we got to treat this like it's a rally or something. Yes, we do, because the first thing I want to say to you is that I want to tell you congratulations for giving your time to come and listen and really hear from some of the people in our community and what they're representing. I think a lot of the things that we've gone through in our lives recently have come from the fact that we are disconnected in so many ways, and we are making assumptions about things that we've never really heard the truth about. And so these sessions, We Can Listen, it's really about us listening to those truths that fly by so quickly because we don't take time out of our day, or we don't take time to really connect with another person and hear about their condition, their human condition. I share this story only because I think I understand what it possibly could be like to not be connected to community. And I want to come from that point first. When you allow a person not to be connected, that's like taking their soul. Because our connectivity comes from our souls speaking to one another. It really is. We are spiritual beings. And when we allow ourselves to disconnect, that means we've allowed ourselves to not see truth and not see it in its rawness, in its beauty, in its conflictedness, in its chaotic state, in its pure, beautiful state. We just don't see. So today, We Can Listen is about us hearing and absorbing and then sharing and then having an opportunity to listen to some other people who are actually working to make things better, and then to find out what it means for us to join the band. Not only join, but become actively involved. My name is Julianne Johnson Weiss, and I'm a native of Portland, Oregon. I am probably better known as a singer and entertainer, but I am also a professor of music and a native of Portland, a true native of Portland. To have traveled around the world and to see how the world speaks of this area and of what we represent, I think there are pieces missing in the history that is being passed on about Portland. Some good things, some wonderful things have happened that we don't talk about. And some not so wonderful things have happened that we should talk about. So tonight, we have some very special guests that are here that are going to share their life's work right now. They are really working hard at connecting the dots for a lot of our community to come together and focus on the houseless community and what it means to be houseless. So the first person that's up to speak is Vahid Brown, and he's going to talk about the Village Model Coalition. Vahid is an organizer and advocate for houseless people. He is a co-founder of Hazelnut Grove and the Village Coalition, and is the housing policy coordinator for Clackamas County. So the process is, I'm going to have Vahid talk a little bit, and then he's going to introduce the next person and the next person until we have this place full of these visionaries that are going to help us make a difference in our community. Okay? So that's our process. And then once we have a chance to hear from each of them and to see and understand what the process is in changing this houseless dynamic, then we're going to go and have a reception We're going to go spend some time in the other room, and you can ask questions and just spend time with the speakers. Then we'll come back in here and ask them some questions as a panel so that they can share from inside what really motivates them to do the work that they do. Okay? So, Vahid Brown, give him a warm round of applause.
Thank you. Yeah, okay, cool. So I'm just going to stay here and we'll speak around the circle. Good evening. Thanks for coming, everybody. I'm Vahid. Imagine a village. Think about that. Think about the picture of a village. What's a village in your mind? What are the characteristics that make that image in your mind a village? Are people connected there with one another? Yeah. It's a family thing, right? It's more than the houses, right? It's more than the things that people sleep in. It's a community. The village is a place maybe where people take care of each other, where they have systems and processes to look out for one another. Maybe the village has no public institutions, no permanent institutions, and so the resources that need to be distributed and the problems that need to be solved and the conflicts that need to be overcome are shared among the people that live in the village. So it has democracy. But you know, in the village in your mind, people have a choice about what they do with their lives, right? They can go to sleep and have a place to do that at the end of the day. They have a community they can engage in and do meaningful work. So that's, just hold that image in your mind and think more about what are the characteristics that make a village, because that's the work that a lot of us do, is we try to make villages. And we work on listening, as Julianne said, and village making with people that definitely don't have access to public institutions, and they definitely don't have resources that people in community do, like maybe the ability to call the police in the instance of being violently abused, or the ability to choose what you're going to do with your day and where you're going to end it and how you're going to sleep and where you're going to sleep. We live in a state and in a series of jurisdictions, Multnomah County and the city of Portland and all the surrounding jurisdictions. In none of the jurisdictions in this state is it legal to be without housing and sleep. It's not legal. Every one of the 6,000 people outside in Portland are breaking the camping ban. They're breaking a city ordinance when they sleep because they don't have housing. And so because of this criminalization, people are subject to constant displacement and interruption of their normal life cycles. So the possibility of community and the possibility of villaging is removed from them, because even basic survival is interrupted and people die. People are killed by the system of displacement that exists in our city. A lot of people. And they die for reasons like they lose all their paperwork, their ID, the things they need to stay connected with their healthcare. They lose the backpack that had their medications in it because they went to the food bank to get their food box. They left their backpack in their tent. And when they got back to the place that they had their tent, it had been removed by inmates and a work crew overseen by Multnomah County sheriffs and put in a storage facility in the middle of nowhere in Clackamas County. And they lost their medicines, right? And so houseless people in the city of Portland and in the jurisdictions that are all around us are in a condition where the making of community, the making of meaningful community in life is interrupted by this criminalization and the inability to reliably be in a place with your body and have molecules and have to sleep. And so the city is constantly called by neighbors who are angry and get them out of here, move them along. You know, there's an RV on my block. There's someone in the bushes. You know, sweep them along. I did a survey of houseless people on the Springwater Corridor for Clackamas County a year and a half ago. One of the most interesting findings was that the vast majority of those people were Oregonians, more than 88% of them. And most people, more than 60% of people, were previously housed in the neighborhood they were currently living in an unhoused way. So they were actually the residents of the neighborhoods. So not only did they get displaced by economic conditions from their housing into their neighborhood without housing, they were then displaced from their neighborhood by this system of criminalization and have to go here and hide and have to go here and hide and have to go over here and hide. That was occurring. That's occurring all the time. And I got involved with some advocates in the city of Portland that were working to kind of challenge this displacement regime and advocate for the rights and well-being and safety of people that are living outside. And the morning that then Mayor Hales announced that he was going to declare a housing state of emergency and do new and different things and relax zoning codes and site shelter in places that hadn't been before. This is in September of 2015, right? That morning, I knew when he made that announcement that a strip of green space on Greeley Avenue where people were camping had been posted to be swept and that all of those people there were going to be displaced. And I thought, you know, I had just learned about that upcoming sweep, and my blood was boiling about it. And when I heard that morning that Mayor Hales was going to do this, I thought, I have an idea. I'm going to go out and just put the mayor on the spot on this. And I went out to that strip of land, and I made a video, you know, with my phone, and I talked to one of the residents who were living in a tent in that space. He's here today. And I said, you know, what's good, Charlie? Like, this is hypocrisy. You're saying you're going to do awesome things and different things and challenge, and this is a group of people that are living here peacefully, trying to look out for each other, not making a bunch of trouble. It's a clean area. It was obviously clean. I had a video. And it went viral on social media. I got 30,000 views or something like that in the first day. Was able to kind of make a nuisance of myself at a press conference the mayor gave that week, and got a foot in the door and said, you know, look, this isn't working for anybody. We're just moving along. And this is a group of people that I know are willing to work together to make them, they're living their work, make it a community, make it a village. So what is that going to take? What is that going to require? And, you know, the mayor and Ben will talk more about the city's, you know, willingness to experiment with community-led initiatives at the time. The Mayor Hales, to his credit, said, okay, I'm going to cancel that sweep and I'm going to give you the space to try to figure out how that works and give the space to those houseless people living there, the autonomy and the dignity and the agency over their own lives to figure out how that works. And that meant coming up with a set of community agreements and codes of conduct, coming up with the ability to cook together, to wash dishes together. We said, okay, city, we need porta potties because we have hygiene needs. So the city said, okay, give you porta potties. We need a dumpster. Okay, you've got a dumpster. That's what the city gave us, a fence, porta potties, and a dumpster. And Hazelnut Grove figured out everything else on its own. It figured out all the community partners it needed to find. It figured out how to get food into the village. It figured out how to eventually create a shower stall. It figured out how to move everyone out of tents and into houses, into tiny houses that they built. They built a village on that ground from living in tents. And at the moment that village making inflection happened, they were about to be subject to displacement and they would have lost everything. And now they have a village. That's pretty cool, right? The Hazelnut Grove, one of its community partners that was critical to it becoming a village of tiny houses and not a community of people subject to displacement at any moment, was the Rebuilding Center. And that's a construction and supplies repurposing and upcycling center in North Portland. And I was going with members of Hazelnut Grove over to the Rebuilding Center to get supplies on a regular basis. And I noticed that so was Dignity Village. And so was Right to Dream 2. And these are the other two houseless villages in the city of Portland. And so it sort of emerged organically that obviously we should get together and form a committee to discuss the problem, right? So the folks from Dignity Village, folks from R2D2, the folks in Hazelnut Grove that were coming with me and Rebuilding Center sort of started conversations about how do we, you know, work strategically around sharing resources and getting wood and you know, plywood to these places so we can make these structures. But also, and very early on, the Center for Public Interest Design at Portland State University got involved because they had a desire to bring design as a human right to this marginalized community and say, look, design is something that can affect your village. Design is something that you can have control over, and design is something that we want to help bring to you. And City Repair, led by Mark Lakeman, who was a founding visionary that started Dignity Village, was also an early member of the Village Coalition, this institution that emerged out of this process. Ben Morrow from the City of Portland was from the very beginning coming to that meeting. And we would meet in the at the Rebuilding Center, and it was a remarkable and really inspiring institution. It is a public institution. It's now a 501c3, but it's also a deliberative body that convenes on a weekly basis and makes decisions about the disposition of resources and the resolution of conflicts and the enactment of policy. It's a democratic public institution that was created by and for largely houseless people, and that's remarkable. That's a remarkable emergence of a form of politics in this community from really below, really actually from below, from a place of having to fight for survival against displacement that could kill you, against the weather that could kill you, the absence of any access to permanent housing in any near time frame, to a place where you are an agent in a process of deliberation that is affecting the policies that are enacted by the other public institutions in this community. And that's a village. I want to introduce Todd Ferry. He's a professor and co-founder of the Center for Public Interest Design at Portland State University. Has been an incredibly important partner in the Village Coalition in bringing design to this community and to this institution. And in it, without that design, we wouldn't have moved the folks in our villages from tents into tiny houses. And without that design, we wouldn't have had the kind of engagement with other parts of the community that we have now in new villages that are opening up coming soon, like one in Kenton neighborhood, which is coming now. We're in the process of putting it together. Todd kind of was instrumental in bringing together the POD initiative that led to the creation of those housing structures. One thing I want to say before I pass the mic is that you see a lot of pictures of structures and a lot of tiny houses. Folks often refer to the tiny house villages or the tiny house communities for houseless people. I just want to emphasize that a village is not the houses, it's not the boxes. A village is not the box. It's the people in them. It's the people that make them. That's the village. So the Village Coalition is not a movement to build little boxes. It's a movement to build big communities. And so just want to put that note in there right at the beginning. But here is Todd Ferry.
You know, before you get started, I'm going to tell you something. For them to kind of quantify what they've been doing with all the passion that they have, I hope that you're feeling and understanding really how important this is for each of us to hear and kind of digest and then figure out what we're going to do. What can we do? Okay, keep thinking along those lines.
Thanks, Wahid. And thank you all for coming. So I'm Todd Ferry. I'm with the PSU Center for Public Interest Design. We are a research, education, and design center focused on exploring how design can serve traditionally underserved communities to expand the role of architects and designers. Design is this incredibly powerful tool, but too often it only benefits the very wealthy. Like many professions, right, that many of you are probably in. And you'll hear from our founding director, Sergio Palleroni, in a little bit. So we began attending the Village Coalition meetings and participating just a little over a year ago. And what became clear quickly was that there was a lot of success that was happening with the villages, particularly with Hazelnut Grove, which was just beginning. There's a lot of a really strong social infrastructure, and that there was a role for design to play that we could help to gather the architecture community together to provide visions for what these villages could look like for shelters that could be done on larger scales, that could be safer, that could be more welcome into communities, that could be a beautiful, dignified place to live. We also wanted to support the Village Coalition's goals to change perceptions about houselessness, right? Because sometimes design can do that. So we started to think about how this could be done, and ultimately we decided, as I mentioned, with partners up here and out there, we brought together, invited the architecture community to come join us for a big community workshop, which in design you call a charrette. This happened at Mercy Corps, and this was just on October 1st of last year. And it was members of the Village Coalition, and it was members of Hazelnut Grove, and other houseless folks and advocates with architects at a table. And filled the room and spent several hours just kind of thinking about how the village model could be supported, particularly through the design of sleeping pods, right, which is what we're calling these sleeping pods because they get around some of the expectations of tiny houses. Sleeping pods aren't, they don't have plumbing and necessarily electricity because those are they have shared kitchens, shared bathrooms that make up a village. And at their largest, their footprint's about 8 foot by 12, which you'll see on the in the boards in the other room. So this was the beginning of a conversation and a start. So the architects kind of heard from the experts in the room, people with lived experience with houselessness, on what would make for a good dwelling. And then they went off and came up with designs that were exhibited. And all of these designs were designed and built by December 8th. So from October 1st to December 8th, there was a real mandate to do it quickly. There's an urgency in the sense that that there is a state of emergency on this issue, right? And winter was coming, and we had a big movement. And so all these architects were building together in a warehouse in freezing temperatures, and it was a real, that was an act of community building while thinking about building different types of communities, which was really fantastic. So that was just through December. And then from that point on, this was, we were exploring as we were going, not necessarily waiting, but exploring with the city what some options were for these. But really, it's one thing to talk about, what if we did this? What if we built these things? What if we had these in place for a village? What was interesting about this process was that the design community got together with experts in the field with lived experience and said, we're going to do this. Now, how are you going to respond? And instrumental in that, in making this happen, both in terms of providing funding and organizing and taking ownership as a city over the POD initiative, was Ben, as well as identifying, okay, we've built these, now where do they go? How do we go from structures to village, right, that will then have a community aspect? So I'm going to hand it over to Ben Morrow.
Thank you, Todd. And so what was really interesting for me is I came in under the Hales administration. So I worked for a mayor in the last year of their administration where there was a state of emergency, where there was a mayor who was not running for re-election. And when you have a political figure who doesn't have the political capital they need to build up for next election, you have the opportunity to do a lot of new and interesting things in a political field, right? And so what, as a staff, we were empowered to do things that were meaningful to us and were meaningful to the city, and to kind of bring in that community support and say, what's going on in the community around houselessness that we can, from a city, from a policy perspective, from an executive level policy, what can we do to help support? And I'm sure a lot of people have opinions on things we did well and things we did poorly. I have opinions on those as well. And so we had the opportunity to experiment, and we had the opportunity to talk with people who are living on the street, talk with advocates, talk with people who are living in villages, talk with architects, talk with everybody about what makes sense, what can we do to move forward. And so right after the state of emergency, Mayor Hales had his bluff called, right, by Vahid and by others, and said, if this is something that's important to you and you're going to try and change the conversation, here's how you can do it. And so that was our first kind of experimentation on this has community support. So this village model has this sense of healing, has this sense of community, has this sense of leadership within it that has a lot of examples of before. It has Dignity Village, we have Right to Dream 2, and we have Hazelnut Grove, where people have experienced both, all of them, right? We have people at Hazelnut Grove who've been at Dignity Village, who've been at Right to Dream 2, who have that kind of lived experience of what has worked in previous ways and what hasn't. And so from a policy perspective, that's the best resource I could possibly have asked for. It was just going in and saying, okay, well, what has made sense? And that was what was great about the Village Coalition and being a partner in there, is we had the opportunity to say, what has worked? How can we come in and how can we do things differently? How can we say, we have the state of emergency, we have these opportunities, we have people like Todd, we have people like Vahid, we have people like DW, you know, everybody, Melissa, Marvin, Desiree, everybody, we have some Hazelnut Grove members who are gonna come up and talk later, but just this opportunity to dig really deep into, the crisis and the actual state of emergency that was happening in people's everyday lives. And so where we came in, we started reviewing what policies don't make sense. And as we're in this absolutely beautiful church property, one of the things we identified was there's an opportunity to change some words in longstanding city code within Title 33 to allow new opportunities for housing. And so what we did was we changed Title 33, which is a lot of your planning code, to say religious institutions can have up to 6 transitional housing units on their property. And so I'm sorry if this is a policy wonk thing, but we changed the word structure to say structures, and from 1 to 6. So now by right, we have churches across the city that could have a transitional housing unit, which is pretty broadly defined, for up to 30 people. And so we have this new mechanism in that we can identify there's a church with extra property, this has maybe a falling congregation level, so we can move in and we can say we have this space that we can do something like Hazelnut Grove, that we can do something like Kenton Women's Village, like Right to Dream 2, all these places that have worked, and the community said, we want this. And so that's where, from the policy side, we came in. And then if I can switch gears entirely again and start talking about Kenton Women's Village a little bit as well. So we were building off of everything it was, and we said, this village model is working, and we want to take the approach that other people have and bring the government in and kind of have the opportunity to say, we're not a protest camp that's coming in, we're working along people who would protest if we weren't doing this, right? And so we had the opportunity to talk with Hazelnut Grove, with the Village Coalition, with CPID, which is the SHRET, and design these buildings. So we had the structures built, and we had this chicken or the egg of, now we need to find where to go. And so we identified property, and we started having the conversation of, there's this plot of land that's owned by the city in North Portland. What can we do with it? And we've gone through this process, and one of our biggest partners in that process has been Catholic Charities. And Margie, come on up.
Margie, come on up.
Margie is the director of the Housing Transitions Program at Catholic Charities, and they've been such an incredible partner from a government side, and I think from an advocate and design side, of how do we bring in this case management aspect that has been missing. So how do we bring in the direct service provision, the direct housing support that we aren't seeing, and how, as a government entity, can we be, making sure that we're answering that call and bringing in the support services that we as a government have. And Margie has been instrumental in that model.
So I want to tell you first that I come from a big old-fashioned agency, and I've worked for big old-fashioned agencies for a long time, and working with people who didn't have homes, 20 years with youth and 12 years now, 14 years with adult single women. No case manager ever saved anyone's life or really ended someone's homelessness. We can write a check, and people will be excessively grateful to you that you write the check that's actually paid for by the city of Portland. And so it bothers me how all social service agencies, and I really mean mostly all, turn people who need your help into victims and into helpless people. And I think the experience of being homelessness, I have no idea what that's like. I've been working with people who are living in that terrible way, and it's not for sissies, for my entire adult life, but I will never know what it's really like to feel that fear and loneliness and isolation and wondering about my future. And so that helplessness, how we do that is we say, stand in line, and this is when we open, and our appointment is at 10, and if you come at 10:20, then we're not gonna be able to meet with you, and we don't care that your camp got swept or what. We are so interested in our processes that we forget about those human beings and what their daily lives are like. And so it's really difficult for people to maneuver through the processes, even if those processes can sometime produce a check that will get you into permanent housing. So Our program works with non-parenting women. The reason we work with that particular population is that they're really underserved. Women with children rightly have more entitlements available to them, but single women really need our help. And so Housing Transitions opened about 10 years ago, and we have a drop-in center, and we place about 100 women in permanent housing every year and then work with them afterwards. So I feel really good about that, but I feel less good about how our processes get in the way of helping people on a day-to-day basis. And so when I heard about the villages, I knew about Dignity Village for many years and visited once, and I loved how it was an opportunity for people to be who they were, not the recipient. People who experience homelessness are recipients over and over and over again, and I can't help thinking that that has an effect on you after a while of crippling your own ability to do things for yourself, and you forget who you were before that happened to you.
That's right.
And so I absolutely love the idea that people will be creating their own lives there. Not that we're going to have case managers there, but those case managers will be directed by the women who live there to help them do what they want to do, not what we think that they should do. And so Catholic Charities is being brave this time, and I'm really proud of them for being involved in something kind of non-traditional. And so we're going to be working with the village manager. There's going to be a staff person working there. And then our case managers will everyone be working with one of the 14 women or a couple of the 14 women up there. So that's what we're going to be doing up there. Thanks very much.
Beautiful. That's beautiful.
Sergio.
Sergio, where are you? Come on up. We're going to have Sergio come up. He's an architect, professor, since 2013, the director of the Center for Public Interest Design, the first such design research center. He is internationally known for his social and environmental activism, providing with his students and collaborators sustainable design solutions to communities in need. Since 1980. Tum, 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 tum.
Wow. I don't know if I can live up to that one. But actually, I feel bad thinking about Heath because he's one of the most eloquent people I've ever met. I think that, this came down to, you can design these houses, you can, homeless can organize themselves, the houseless can organize themselves to become villages, to create the support that we aren't providing them. And yet, in the end, there has to be a discussion because the consensus, the kind of the moment where the mayor reaches out and says, okay, we have to create an opportunity, it has to come down to some community taking it up. And Kenton was actually interesting because it's like any other community, it's a community that's has struggled to put itself together and has done it successfully, like so many communities in this city. But it's been a struggle of people, like average working people, coming together and making right decisions and doing it as a community. And what we were asking them was actually, we didn't want to just dump them there. The mayor realized that even though he could politically just put them there, really consensus had to be built. And consensus was built through a process of what we would call design, but really was actually having a conversation with the community about what they envisioned their community to be and their future to be, and could another community live within it and become part of their community and maintain their values. And so in the winter, starting actually the first meeting during the big snowstorm and through several other snowstorms, we had these extraordinary meetings where we just sat down with people and said, okay, what are the values? What are the things your community is about? What do you envision the future? How could another community contribute, and what do you need, and how could this community contribute to that future? And we play the role of architects and designers, which is just have that conversation, at least the kind of architects and designers that Todd and I are trying to create, which is have this kind of conversation and turn around and say, okay, well, this is what that might look like. So we'd come back the next time and draw it up and say, okay, this is what this vision would look like, this is what this one. So kind of essentially curating a social process. And essentially social process, which is like a civic process. Essentially, we're teaching our students and young architects and architects in the city to be, you know, to become part of civic society, you know, something that we've forgotten about, which Portland is famous for, but really we need to exercise more. And so it was an amazing process, and we had amazing partners here. And I don't know if anyone here was at the Kenton, the final vote at Kenton, other than the people. But it was like, it was this one of these, you know, kind of civic realist movies of the black and white movies of the 1940s with like the mayor getting up there and making a pitch and people yelling and, you know, and different constituencies getting up, but that's not true. And I couldn't have ever predicted the vote, which ended up being almost 3-1 in favor. But in the entire process, it felt like it was a kind of microcosm of the whole discussion we've had as a country and as a nation. And yet in the end, the kind of people's will and having been part of this process and discussion and the fact that everybody was included won the day. So I think if anything came out of this process, and to me it's extraordinary, and started with this extraordinary revelation of this, what I think is one of the most extraordinary acts of deep democracy I've ever seen in my life, which was participating in what the Village Coalition has been able to do, you know, where people get up there and say, this is, you know, I want to propose this, and people say, well, you know, that really doesn't serve the community, and people respecting that, all the way to this kind of public process with Kenton, with the mayor, with people like Catholic Services, everybody coming forward, has been an amazing experience of, I think, like a civic lesson, you know, a civic lesson you used to get in high school, you know, this is about civics. Well, you were actually living it. And I think it's, for us, it's kind of been a model of, you know, kind of actually a practice of what we've kind of forgetting maybe in the internet age, that we really need to talk to each other and listen to each other, because we're getting so disconnected, we're forgetting that we are a great nation. It was built on kind of the conversations that the Constitution allowed us to have with each other, in which we built consensus. And so I think if at the heart of what we do at Center, and certainly our mayors are doing, and Catholic Services, and definitely our partners here, you know, in the houses community, they're teaching us that we've forgotten to the process of arriving at consensus, which is, you know, in the end, you know, arriving at that consensus is what we need, because this does not solve the crisis. What we need to do is take that consensus we're building and vote for change, because we're the only advanced country in the world that has no public housing, just like it has no, you know, health insurance, national health insurance, like it has many things that it's missing, and somehow we've gotten there, even though people believe in those values. So this is like a, for us, it was like a microcosm of, you know, of the issues that we face as a nation, and finding and coming out feeling incredibly, we were all crying and hugging at the vote, because we were like feeling, oh my God, you know, democracy won. We stand for human values and for change. So that was really amazing. Thank you.
But we do know that the process was the most important, correct? And we're not done. We're not finished. You know, I thought about this the other day when we were talking about the marches that the young people were doing, you know, for change. And they thought that if they marched, then they won. And we know, those of us who have kind of gone through this before, that the marching is the beginning. And it's to build the people to come to you, to join your cause, to make an effort to make change. And so we're excited about having you all here. And it's so great to see that each one of you had an integral part in making this happen. And I think, do you understand a little bit more now about the process that came to be here to make this happen? I think you need to hear from the heart a little bit, right? You want to hear from the heart a little bit? I'm going off the board, you guys. I'm going off the board. Come upstairs here. Come see me. This is a beautiful artist. And you can find out a little bit later. Oh, this part, the Red Sea, and she's in. And I want to find out from you. You said that you had a song that you would share with community? First of all, can one of you introduce and tell us who I'm talking to right now?
Absolutely. So you're talking to Melissa Castro. She is the lovely wife of Brian Castro right there, a member of Hazelnut Grove, and one of our most favorite people.
Okay. So tell me, have you experienced houselessness? Have you experienced that?
Yes, I have.
Okay. You know what? When you were describing to me about how you use your voice, what did you use your voice to do in the situation that you were in?
Well, when you're houseless, you go out and you find places to eat. I went into a church called Red Door, and there was lots of people in there. There was a lot of volunteers with children, beautiful faces, but the chaos was growing and intensifying. People were screaming. My husband's PTSD got set off, so he had to step out of the building. And I was sitting with my meal, and I just stood up and started to sing. And the room instantly got quiet. I mean, there's hundreds of people that were screaming. The kids were smiling, the staff there, church, the Catholic Church, they were all just like putting their hands together, like it got quiet and it was just peaceful, and it stayed peaceful that rest of that day till we left, because we usually volunteer to help with art room or to teach someone how to crochet or something.
So what is the importance of that kind of peacefulness to this community?
It's very important. I think people forget to realize that all these people are still humans, and they are still having the human experience, which might not be so great. So in some way, I connected with them by using my voice to reach out to them, to calm them, to calm their spirits, to let them know it's okay, and that there's someone there that understands, that just wanted to calm everyone, to let them know it's okay.
You're the mama of the community, the village.
They called
right?
me Mama Bear under our bridge.
I'm dying to hear you. Would you share just a little bit of the song that you sang?
Sure.
For them? Don't you want to hear the song that she sang? Because I think the humanness of what's happening here is so beautiful. And I want you to know that there are faces and names and people who truly need to be honored just for existing, just for being here and making it through the journey that they had taken that was not necessarily self-imposed. Okay? It's just, we are in a time where something may happen and you don't have your check. And that means you don't have your payment, which means you don't have your house. It's not that you haven't robbed anybody, you haven't done anything negative, or you just are a person with a circumstance. But you are a person first. And that's why I'm asking her to sing, because that's the connectivity that happens between human souls. We communicate with one another, and then we care. So,
the song I decided to sing at that church, it was just brought upon me, and I just stood up and started singing "I Will Always Love You" by Whitney Houston. If I should stay, I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way.
You got it? Come on. I'll do it with you. Mm-hmm.
And I will always love you, will always love you. You, my darling, I love you, you. I'll always love you.
All right, so they went by this pretty well, right? They watched their clock and everything, and I didn't want them to feel rushed in any way. Is there something or anything that you want to share that you think that we have missed for this segment?
I think you should tell them where you got married. I mean, I think that this is so telling of how there's a parallel society that we don't acknowledge and how it survives and has all the dignity of a regular. Come on, guy. Get up here.
You the star. Where's your people? Somebody be his people.
Thank you, Ben. Well, we lived under Morrison Bridge. We made a community there, under a bridge. We cleaned it up, made it presentable and approachable. Children would come sing to us, churches would come, and these churches loved us, and we started holding mass under our bridge on Sundays.
We're ministers for our church, Father's House at PSU. We had about 25 people, mostly vets, people with PTSD. I suffer from PTSD. I have the distinction of having been exploded. So, you know, we had a lot more empathy. We had elderly, really nice, sweet people. We had a fatality under our bridge. A house person came by and decided to kick somebody while they were sleeping. That person died. 48 minutes. We are 3 blocks away from EMT services. I'm on the phone 5 minutes after the guy's kicked, 48 minutes. They're 3 blocks away. I could have walked down there, grabbed the guy, and made him come. We had to stop traffic at NATO. Finally, a woman in a Range Rover. I had to stop her car, stop NATO. Rush hour. People were driving around this man. He was in the street. I've been on the streets of Portland for 8 years. 7 of them on cement. Been an activist the entire time. Got my start mostly with Occupy and then Ibrahim Mubarak, who was a huge influence on me with Right to Dream 2, Right to Survive. Sorry. Wow. Yeah, so we got married at our church. That was pretty cool. We're well liked by our congregation. They're a bunch of really great people. We're hoping to get more faith-based institutions behind the idea of just being good neighbors and Christians to folk. Whether you believe it or not, the Houseless community are your neighbors. They are in your community. They may have been there their whole lives. Maybe they're newer. I don't know. I like to think that we live in a country where you could kind of choose to move around as you please, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody.
So together, you were married where exactly?
At Father's House at PSU.
Okay.
Last year.
Okay. So that was beautiful. It was just like you had come to a full circle into just ministering now to the people that you were part of the community and are still a part of the community, right? You don't ever break those bonds, right?
No.
Those are still there and intact.
And I was telling you that going out into the community, to the different camps or spots where people hang out, mm-hmm. to share the good news and to pray for people or to bring them things they might need, mm-hmm. you know, special requests. They're more accepted because they know we work in the community at different organizations like Sisters of the Road Cafe or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Oh, they've seen us at the other feeds. So they're more accepted of speaking to the group, the church mm-hmm. group, and receiving prayer or blessings mm-hmm. Because they know who we were and they mm-hmm. know that we know where they're coming from mm-hmm. and they've seen us and they know us. So they were a lot more acceptant to talk with us and mm-hmm. be open and tell us their stories and how can we help you. That's what our church organization, our ministry is called, How Can We Help?
How can we help? That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, in the other room, we actually have some posters, some hangings that you can see that show you these communities that we're talking about. And then when we take a little break, we're going to go in and experience that, and you'll have a chance to ask some questions of our panelists and chat with them for a few and get something to drink and just kind of hang together and be a community in this old church. And then we're going to come back. And when we come back, we have another couple of guests to come up, and then we'll close this out. But everyone will get a chance to listen to them talk amongst themselves about certain issues and questions that we might ask. Okay? So thank you very much. Don't go home. There's food and something to drink in the other room and a chance for you to see examples of these communities. Okay? Thank you very much, and we'll be right back.
On the spot, you're singing.
Whoa.
I love to hear you sing. I love to hear you.